We just ask for illumination tonight. Speak to our hearts. Lord, I specifically ask you to help me to just hand-tailor this thing for those that are here tonight. Jesus, we glorify you. We thank you for our salvation. Thank you for this journey we're on, for this process that's going on in our lives. Lord, you are good all the time, and we're grateful for it. Amen. I'd like you to open your Bibles to Exodus, if you would, chapter 19. We will be looking there shortly, Exodus chapter 19. I want to do a little spin-off of the Ten Commandments that we were talking about, as I said, over the last several months. And I want to tie it to marriage. Now, if you're single here tonight thinking, man, I could have been at Starbucks. He's going to talk about marriage. Why am I here? Listen, we're going to share some things that will help you as a single person. If you're single and have never been married, if you're divorced, if you're widowed, whatever the case might be, is going to help you as much as the married people if you'll keep your antennas up and keep an open heart. Good marriages, good relationships don't just happen. They have to be worked at. People don't just get lucky, marry the right person, and have a great marriage. A good marriage has to be built on more than passion. It has to be built on principle. And in the Scriptures, we find the absolute best guidelines and principles for a healthy marriage and a healthy relationship anywhere in the world. And the good things is God's words are never outdated. His principles, they don't just work for someone living in the Middle East 2,000 years ago. They're just as applicable today as they ever were. Now tonight I want to go back 3,500 years and look at some wedding vows that are extremely relevant today. I don't know if you realize it or not, but God looked at Israel as His bride. He called Israel His bride. In the book of Jeremiah, God says, "You've been an unfaithful wife," talking to His people, so much so that He put them away and gave them a bill of divorce. In the book of Hosea, in the book of Ezekiel, the Lord uses the same analogy that He is married to His people, and the metaphor is carried on into the New Testament. The church is called the bride of Christ. God is saying the closest relationship that you can understand, the most intimate relationship that you can understand as a human being, that's how close I want to be with you. And so after God brings His people out of the land of Egypt, He gives Moses the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments. And as we found out from studying them, they weren't just a list of do's and don'ts. It's not some stairway to heaven. As much as anything, they were wedding vows for God's people. God was saying, if you want to have a long-term relationship with me that is healthy and growing, here's what you need to do. In fact, just before He gives them the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, look at the language He uses as He addresses them in Exodus chapter 19, beginning in verse 4. "You've seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine." That is romantic, intimate language. I brought you to myself. You're my special treasure. And then God gives them, as we come to chapter 20, the Ten Commandments. In verse 3, we find commandment number 1. He says, "You'll have no other gods before me." In verses 4 and 5 and 6, He talks about not making a graven image to bow down to it. In verse 7 is commandment number 3, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." Commandment number 4 is in verse 8, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." Commandment number 5, verse 12, "Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you." Commandment number 6, "You shall not murder." Commandment number 7, "You shall not commit adultery." Commandment number 8, "You shall not steal." Number 9, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." And finally, commandment number 10, "You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his SUV, nor anything else that he has, not even his garden hose." Don't covet. Now, I want to briefly touch on, you know, their relevance to you know, our relationship with God vertically, and we spend a lot of time on that. But I'll touch on that, and then we just want to shift them and talk about how these same principles apply to a love relationship and a marriage relationship between a man and a woman. All right, commandment number one, God says, you'll have no other gods before me. God is saying, I want an exclusive relationship with you. I want to be your one and only, not just flavor of the month. St. Augustine said, if Christ is not valued, he's not valued at all unless he's valued above all. How appropriate in marriage as well. It's an exclusive relationship. Henry Ford, on his 50th wedding anniversary, was asked, you know, how he had such a successful marriage. His response was this: I've had a successful marriage for the same reason I've been successful in business. I stick to one model. In traditional wedding vows, the husband and wife pledge their devotion until death do us part. There's no competition. For me, Janet is it. I'm not shopping for another model. I won't be shopping in the future for another model. Hopefully she won't be doing any shopping either. It's to be an exclusive relationship. Prior to being saved, that was not part of exclusiveness. Just wasn't even in my thought patterns when it came to relationships with the opposite sex. And it's never meant to be that way in a marriage. I mean, when you get married, that's it. When God took a rib out of Adam, he just took one rib and he made one woman. He didn't take four or five ribs out. Say, okay, Adam, here's Eve, and here's Samantha, and here's, you know, Joyce, and here's Lois. And it's exclusive. There's just one. And coming into a marriage, that's just it. That's it. One person. I'm not shopping anywhere else. I'm not window shopping. Everybody say one model. All right, commandment number two. God said not to make a carved image of anything in the heaven, above, and earth, or in the sea. He wanted to make sure everything was covered. And he said, don't bow down to it. All right? He's saying, don't make images of me and then worship them. Don't love or worship a substitute for me. Love me. Now, you think about that in connection with marriage. You know, in religion, people make pictures, they make statues, they make idols, and then they call them holy, but all of them are substitutes. And God in our relationship with Him says, no substitutes. You need to have relationship with me. And in marriage, we shouldn't have substitutes. Love your spouse and find fulfillment with him or with her. Find your fulfillment in that relationship, not in a substitute. When a man watches pornography, he's loving a substitute. His sexuality and his passion is pointed to those images. That's a substitute. Sometimes a man, and maybe a woman, they get caught up in their career, that's where they find their fulfillment. And so their little world revolves around their job and their work, and they seem to be fulfilled. And mama, she's got this absence in her life, so her world is all wrapped up in the kids. And that's where she finds her fulfillment. And it looks like a happy home. They're married, you know, 10 years, things seem to be fine. 15 years, things seem to be fine. 20 years, maybe 25. Everything's great until he retires. Or until the kids grow up and leave home. And then suddenly there's a crisis and you find people getting divorced after 25 years of marriage. It's because they were like two ships passing in the night. They had substitutes instead of the real thing. His substitute, his mistress was his work. You know, her mistress was the kids or whatever it might be. We can't have substitutes. We must endeavor to find fulfillment in our relationship with our spouse. All right, commandment number three. Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. God's saying, if you want to have a good relationship with me, speak well of me. Watch your words. And the phrase in vain, don't take the name of the Lord in vain, means empty or meaningless, insincere, not showing due respect. Whenever you speak flippantly or lightly about someone, it weakens your respect for them. It doesn't change them, it changes your attitude toward them. And sometimes I think believers are a little too casual in their speech toward God. Yes, I know He's Father. He's my Father. I bring to all of my problems to Him. There's an intimacy, there's a closeness there, but I also remember in balancing that He is the Creator of the universe. And one day I'll stand before Him and give an account of my life. And the Apostle Paul, thinking about that day, called it the terror of the Lord. So yes, He is God, He's our Father, but He's also Creator. And there needs to be a balance there. And God in our relationship with Him says, you need to speak well of me. You need to not take my name in vain, not treat it flippantly. And sometimes husbands and wives, they speak lightly of one another. And their words affect the way they feel about one another. There are a few things that can affect a marriage like words. Learn to build one another up with your words. Be lavish with your praise. The book of James likens our tongue to the rudder on a ship. You know, a captain stands at the wheel, whether it's a huge battleship or some cruise liner. Anybody in the house going on a cruise down to Mexico or the Caribbean? Anybody got that plan for this summer? Anybody in here? Anybody ever been on one of those cruise ships? All right, a few of you. So why aren't you going back again? What was wrong with the cruise? They're huge, aren't they? And you know what? One man or one woman can stand at the helm with that wheel and turn the direction of that entire ship. The Bible says our tongue is the same thing. Some people are sending their marriage, the ship of their marriage, in the wrong direction. I was out with a couple of friends, actually, late one night. We were lobster diving about 1 a.m. And I'm in the water with another guy, and you can hear there's some guys out on the other side of this rock pile going up and down in this cigar boat, you know, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, zoom, zoom. I mean, just going fast back and forth. And then all of a sudden you hear this boom. And we're in the water, and the guy that's running the boat says, I got to go see what that was. And actually what they'd done is ran their cigar boat at about 60 miles an hour into the rocks, shot straight up in the air about 30 feet, came down and sunk. And so there's two guys floating around in the water. One of them's got a broken leg, and it was freezing, middle of winter out there, a pair of shorts on, T-shirts. And so our guy came and picked him up and then left us out in the water out there for about 45 minutes while he, you know, took him into, you know, to the dock in there and got some help for him. You know, the boat didn't just hit the rocks by itself. It got steered into the rocks. Marriages don't end on the rocks of divorce just by happenstance. They get steered there most of the time with the words that people speak. Think about the words that you're speaking in your marriage. Are they critical? Are they demeaning? Are they negative? Those are having an effect on your relationship. Choose to speak words that build up. Speak words that give life. If you don't want to have a divorce, don't talk divorce. If you don't want your marriage to end up on the rocks, don't talk that way. Look for good things to put into your spouse. Janet and I were at a minister's meeting some years back, and I've been convinced for a long time that 95% of the preachers preach too long. Some people just think they're a lot better than they are. Most people are not good enough to preach 90 minutes. I'm not good enough to preach 90 minutes. I'm just not. But some people think they are. And people's attention span usually lasts about as long as their rear end lasts. And we're in a meeting, and this guy, brilliant material, but he was so boring. Just this monotone, on and on. And he went for 2 hours and 10 minutes. And so I'm trying to stay awake and you know, trying my best to concentrate. And I look over, and there's a couple there, and they got their two sons, about 13 years old and 15 years old. And those two boys, they took notes and listened the whole time. We're all fidgeting, and I thought, they're robots, surely. The parents must have them on drugs, something. And so after the meeting got over, Jen and I went over. I wanted to talk to these parents. I said, look, I got to ask you a question. I said, I've seen lots of teenage kids, and our kids were a lot smaller, you know, back then. I said, how did you do that? What's your secret? And so they began to tell me and then shared some of their secrets with their boys. And one thing led into another. And they began talking about how, you know, the boys, you know, they fought, but they were really good with each other. Said, because we make them, if they get in a fight, they have to face one another, look in one another's eyes and say, you know what, you're my brother. I love you. I'd never do anything to hurt you. And they said, it just works amazing things. And said, we found the same thing works in marriage. And my ears pricked up. They turned out to be pastors out in the desert area. Said, we have couples that will come in to counsel. And a lot of times it's just, you know, they've already made up their mind. They're divorcing. They just want to say that they tried everything. And the husband sits on this side of the couch. The wife sits on that side of the couch. They cross their arms and look in the opposite direction. And they say, now, okay, you've got, Pastor, you've got 30 minutes to fix our marriage. And he says, what we have them do is we have them face each other, which is a titanic task in and of itself. We have them face one another, and then we make them say something good about their spouse. He says, and sometimes they just don't want to do it. Say, you know what? You married them for a reason. There's got to be some good attribute. Maybe they're good with the kids. Maybe they work hard. Maybe they do their best to look nice. You find something good. Look them in the eye and say it. So, okay, you are good with the kids. I do. You know, you appreciate the way you are with the kids. Well, I appreciate the fact that you work. You do work hard and you do care about the family. I appreciate that. So, okay, now think of something else. And it'll be the whole session just to get them to do that. And now, if we're going to help you, if we're going to speak to you again, you have homework for the next week or 2 weeks or whatever it is. Every single day, you have to do this at least 3 times a day. Look one another in the face and say something that you like about the other person, something you appreciate about them. And his words, he said, Bayless, it works like magic. And we know it's not magic, it's the power of the principles of God's Word. He said, they come back in, this couple that sat on opposite sides of the couch, and he says, we've seen it happen again and again. Look in the other direction, they come back arm in arm. It's like two heads stuck on one body. And they say, God has worked a miracle in our marriage. Well, friend, it's just the power of speaking the right kind of words. It is so incredibly important that we learn to do that. All right, the next commandment, commandment number 4, is found in verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We know that Sabbath means to lay down your work. It means an intermission, a rest from labor. And the word holy means separate to God. So put down your work and spend time with God. God is saying, if you want a long-term relationship with me, we have got to spend time together. We have to have special time. Exclusive time. Extravagant time together. God says, I want a whole day. Every week, I want a whole day. Now, in order to have a healthy, growing marriage, husbands and wives need time together. Special time. Exclusive time. Sometimes extravagant time. And we all know it won't happen unless we plan it. It has to be a high priority. So many times couples are just trying to squeeze one another into their busy schedules. I mean, it's almost like, pull out the Palm Pilot. Well, all right, dear, Thursday between 4 o'clock and 4:40, I can fit you in. And I'm sure that's long enough for us to have a very deep, vulnerable, meaningful conversation. So see you on Thursday. It is almost that bad with some couples. But if you're going to have a good marriage, you have to spend time together. Some people schedule every other thing in the world first. Time with their friends, time for sports, you know, everything else, while the wife and the husband just gets a few spare minutes here and there. You can't build a good marriage without time. You can't do it. Janet, in the marriage seminar we were teaching, shared actually a figure, you know, a certain amount of hours every week that a husband and wife should spend together. And I'm thinking, guy, you know, that's a lot. It was a pretty high goal. But then she shared a figure that had been gained from polling different people. The average husband and wife spent approximately 37 minutes a week in face-to-face conversation. Think about how it was before you got married. What was your phone bill like? My oldest son, you know, seeing a girl, and we got his. We looked at how many text messages he had sent. I thought it was a mistake. So this is not possible. You haven't slept in a month. This is not possible for someone to send this many text messages. But you think about it. Before we were married, we did everything we could do to spend time together, didn't we? We fought for time. We were on the phone. We were writing letters. We were going out to lunch. We were going out to dinner. We were spending time together. And people get married, and that dissipates and falls by the wayside. We have to have time together if we're going to have strong marriage relationships. I had a friend, his job took him away from home. And he told me, he said, Bayless, he was a golfer, and I enjoy a good game of golf. But he said, golf cost me my first marriage. And I worked out, he told me how many rounds of golf he played, and I know how much time it takes to play. He spent 25 work weeks, entire 40-hour work weeks, 25 work weeks a year playing golf. No wonder it cost him his marriage. His wife didn't even know who he was. Now, from this point, we're going to shift gears a little bit and get into some character issues. And single people, you need to listen carefully here. God is saying, if you want a good relationship with me, you need to show these kind of characteristics. And in marriages, these are the kind of characteristics you need to look for. If you're single and looking, these are the things you need to look for in a person. All right, the next commandment, commandment number 5 in verse 12, honor your father and your mother. Now, among other things, God is saying that we must be grateful. Grateful people make good partners. Among other things, parents put much toil, energy, time, money into the raising of their children. They work hard to give their children an edge in life, and it's tragic when a child is ungrateful or unthankful. William Shakespeare said, "How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child." And when you get someone that is ungrateful toward their parents and feels no responsibility toward them, it will color every area of their life as well. Some people are selfish and they feel like the world owes them a living. Before I was saved, now I did not personally indulge in this, but I had numerous friends that did, and to me it seemed like the whole community did. I lived up in Oregon for about 4 years, and people that were my age, almost, I'd say half of them, got food stamps from the government. And I knew some of them were getting welfare checks, you know, from the government. They could work, they didn't want to work, so they're getting welfare checks and they're getting food stamps. And there might be a big demonstration against the establishment, you know. And they say, "Hey, you know, I'll be there, but I got to pick up my food stamps first. I'm going to let the government take care of me. I'm going to let them pay for my food. I'm going to let them pay for my rent. And then I'm going to go demonstrate against them." A total attitude of ingratitude. And there are some people, they just feel like everybody in the family owes it to them. If a child feels like, you know, mom and dad owe me everything. It's carried over in life. It's very difficult to have a relationship with a selfish, unthankful person. Thank you is a very, very important phrase in marriage. If someone takes you for granted and takes all your efforts for granted, it makes it real hard to live with them. Everybody say thank you. That wasn't so hard, was it? And I know some of you wouldn't, no matter what I say, you wouldn't say it with me, would you? Thank you. We need to tell people we appreciate them. You know, say, "Well, I, in my heart, I do appreciate my wife. Doesn't do her any good if you don't tell her." "Well, in my heart, I really am appreciative of my husband. Doesn't do him a lick of good if you don't tell him." See, we might feel good about ourselves thinking, "I really am a grateful person. I'm really a thankful person." But if we don't vocalize that, no one else benefits from it at all. And chances are, if you don't vocalize it, you aren't. You're deceived about yourself, because Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Be lavish in your praise. And if there's not much that you can praise them for, find something that you can praise them for and then vocalize that. All right, command number 6, don't murder. All right, don't kill your spouse. Very hard to have a relationship with someone after you murder them. If you kill your wife, things just sort of go downhill from there. Jesus, of course, elaborated on this commandment in Matthew chapter 5, and he said these words, "You've heard that it was said, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Whoever murders shall be in danger of the judgment.' But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment." So Jesus talked about the root cause of murder, which is anger. If we're going to have good, healthy, lasting marriages, we need to learn to be gentle. People that are easily angered, that are violent, or that have an explosive temper destroy relationships. You go to some people's houses and there's holes in the wall. There's a hole in the door. You go down the hallway, there's a hole in the wall next to the bathroom. And if you took away some of the pictures, you'd find holes in the wall behind the pictures. Because Papa gets angry and he puts his fist through the wall. I was with some friends once. We were having a bit of a solemn moment. We've been talking about a friend of ours that had passed away. And I guess his newlywed wife just didn't get it. And we're in there and he's talking about this, and she's vacuuming away. You know, move your feet. And she's, you know, going with the vacuum. And her husband got angry at her because she wasn't sensitive to our solemn mood. He walks over, and they've been married 2 weeks. He walks over, grabs the vacuum out of her hand and threw it through the wall. There's a hole this big in the wall, and then he just sat back down and never said a word to her. Marriage didn't last too long. Explosive tempers like that will destroy a relationship. And it's not always the guy that has the temper. Some of the ladies have the temper too. Go to the house and, hey, the TV remote doesn't work because she's thrown it across the room. And the dishes are busted because she's thrown the dishes. And she'll fight and she'll curse and she'll scream. And she's got the temper as well. If you're dating someone that blows up easily, that loses their temper quickly, take it as a warning sign. Even if you're in traffic, somebody cuts them off and they blow their stack. You may be planning on marrying. Maybe you ought to think twice about that. Anger erodes relationships. If you have a temper, get it under control or the devil will control you through it. Now, another common expression of anger is when people put on an angry countenance and go stony silent. The person that responds this way generally uses their silence and angry moodiness to punish whoever they're upset with. And again, it's not healthy for a marriage relationship. If you anger quickly and forgive slowly, you will be a hard person to live with. And maybe you don't break the TV remote by throwing it against the wall, but you get upset and there it is on your face, and you are going to punish your husband until you think he's had enough. Are you going to punish your wife until you think she's had enough? And you're going to be stony silent. And it's going to be walking on eggshells around the house to be with you. If you anger easily and forgive slowly, you are a difficult person to live with. Make it a point of earnest prayer to get a handle on your anger. Because if you don't master it, it will master you. And it'll not just affect your marriage relationship. It'll affect every other meaningful relationship that you have in life. And don't blame it on being Irish. You can get a handle on your anger. All right, the next commandment. God said, you shall not commit adultery. That was in verse 14. With God, of course, that's when we put other things before Him. God calls that spiritual adultery. And obviously in a marriage, you would be hard-pressed to imagine anything more damaging than unfaithfulness. Be faithful to your wife. Be faithful to your husband, not just in action, but be faithful in your thought life as well. And again, Jesus expounded on that in Matthew chapter 5, and I quote to you. You've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks on a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. A lustful, exploitive disposition has no place at all in a marriage relationship. Love gives, lust takes. Love serves, lust demands. Love nourishes, lust chokes. Sex is good. In marriage, God created it, should be enjoyed. It is a God-given gift, but lust has no place even in the marriage bed. Now, as we said before, God doesn't close His eyes when you make love to your husband or wife. He's not going like, could you please hurry up? You know, I'd really like to come and bless you, but just come on, come on, come on. Now, God created sex. Sex is good. Sex is holy. But when it goes outside of its bounds, it becomes harmful. Electricity is good. Can warm your house, can cook your food, can bring light in the room. But when it's used improperly, it can kill you. And this sexual desire that God has put inside of us within the confines of marriage in the right way, it's wonderful. But you get it outside of that, and it can be quite damaging. Now, I just want to give you quickly three thoughts to affair-proof your marriage. Three thoughts to affair-proof your marriage. Communication, companionship, and closeness with God. Number one, there needs to be affirming communication. If you're going to affair-proof your marriage, there needs to be affirming communication. Look with me, if you would, in the Song of Solomon. We've got Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and then the Song of Solomon, written, of course, by Solomon. And this book deals with some of the wonders of intimate physical love between a husband and wife. And as much as you want to get an analogy of Christ and the church out of it, and it is there, I'm sure, to some degree, more than anything else, it just deals with physical intimacy and emotional intimacy in marriage. And we come to chapter 7. I want you to look there with me. We could go all over the book and find what we're going to look at in chapter 7, but I think this is just a prime example of affirming communication. Here Solomon is talking to his young Shulamite bride, and this is what he says to her. "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skillful workman. Your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies." And yes, that was a compliment. "Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes like the pools in Heshbon, by the gate of Beth-Rabbin. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon." Again, a compliment, surely, which looks towards Damascus. "Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple. A king is held captive by your tresses. How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights." And I want you to notice, Solomon is complimenting her body, which was very important in her case, because in chapter 1, it's very evident that this was an area of insecurity for her. As she's sharing in chapter 1, she says, "Don't look on me because I'm dark." She'd been tanned from working out in the vineyard. She was a simple country girl, and she felt insecure when compared to the fair-skinned, pampered ladies of the court. And Solomon very wisely built her up where she felt most insecure. But instead of doing that, many times a husband will tear his wife down brick by brick in areas that she feels insecure, or the wife will tear her husband down brick by brick in areas where he feels insecure, rather than building them up. I'll let you in on a little secret. And by the way, the Shulamite does the same thing, not only when she's talking to him, but when her friends say, "You know, what is it about this guy? Tell us about him." And she goes on and speaks these affirming words about him. Ladies, here's a little secret. Us men, we're just little boys in big bodies. And it's very, very important for us to be admired. Okay? When we strut, tell us we're great. We need to hear that. Some of you guys, you'll know what I'm talking about. You can remember back, any of you play Little League or play Pop Warner football or anything like that? Maybe played soccer as a kid. If your dad was ever involved in those things, I'll guarantee you there's a not just a handful, a bunch of men in here that remember back after you had some good game and your dad came up and said, "Hey, well done. Man, you pitched a great game, son. That was an awesome hit you got." I can still remember things back when I was in Little League 40 years ago that my father said to me. I remember he came out to one of my track meets one day when I was running in track. I was in junior high school. And I didn't even win the race. I was running the 1320. I didn't even win. And Dad came up to me afterwards and says, "You know what? I watched you run." He says, "I don't think you could have run that any better than you ran it." I still remember. I was 13. That was a major thing for me. There's something in us we need to be affirmed. In fact, if you read where it's all boiled down in Ephesians chapter 5, it says, "Husbands, you know, love your wives. Women more than anything else want to be loved." And it said, "Wives, respect your husbands. More than anything else, men want to be respected." And the Amplified Bible says, "Respect him and admire him exceedingly." We need to be affirmed. Husbands and wives need to affirm one another. And if a husband is starved for affirming conversation, or if a wife is starved for affirming conversation, it opens the door of temptation. Mark this place, if you would, and look back with me in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 5. Numerous times in the book of Proverbs, it talks about unfaithfulness in marriage and the consequences of adultery. But as well as doing that, again and again and again, the writer in Proverbs tells us how adulterous relationships begin. Proverbs 5, and look with me at verse 3 if you would. "For the lips of an immoral woman drip honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil. But in the end, she's bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. In the end, it'll be bitter. In the end, you're going to be wounded. That's how it ends, but how does it start? It starts with someone's lips that drip honey, and whose mouth, meaning their speech, is smoother than oil. It starts with talk. Look in chapter 6 with me, if you would. Verse 23. For the commandment is a lamp and the law a light. Reproofs of instruction are the way of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the flattering tongue of a seductress. Then it goes on after it and it talks about an adulteress preying on the precious life and the results of someone that can get us involved in an immoral relationship. But it starts with flattery. Now, we know flattery is not sincere, but if you have not been affirmed by your marriage partner, you're going to be starved for it. And there's something in us that just gravitates towards affirming words, even if deep down inside we know it's just flattery. Look in chapter 7 with me, if you would. Verse 4. Say of wisdom, you're my sister, and call understanding your nearest kin, that they may keep you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. Look in verse 21. With her enticing speech, she caused him to yield. With her flattering lips, she seduced him. Now, we know it works both ways. Husbands, listen to me. If you are not building up your wife, the devil will try and send somebody else to do it. It may be some guy at work. All he has to do is say, you are awesome. That sticks with a lady. All it takes, if a husband's being starved for it, is for some woman to say, you know what? Man, that was brilliant. Where do you get these ideas? Man, you look good. You work out. You stay pretty fit. That sticks in a guy's head. She thinks, I look good. My wife never says that. And see, the devil will prey upon that and try and get a whole thing spinning in a person's head. Now, that does not justify someone that's fallen into an immoral relationship. No, no, no. But it helps explain how that can happen. If you're going to affair-proof your marriage, there must be affirming conversation. It's so important. All right, the second thing. Affirming conversation. Number two is companionship. Unhurried time together. Look back with me, if you would, in Song of Solomon. There needs to be companionship. Unhurried time together. We touched on that when we looked at the commandment about the Sabbath. God saying, I want exclusive, extravagant time with you. Now here, Solomon, and catch the flow of this thing. He's been complimenting his bride. He's been speaking affirming words to her. And look at her response in verse 10. I'm my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. He really loves me. And she goes on, look at verse 11. Come, my beloved, let's go forth to the field. Let us lodge in the villages. Let's go get a hotel. That's what she's saying. Let's go spend some time together. Well, dear, what are we going to do there? Ah, glad you asked. Verse 12, let us get up early to the vineyards. Let's see if the vine is budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give off a fragrance. And at our gates are pleasant fruits, all manner new and old, which I've laid up for you, my beloved. Now, in the Bible, in the Scriptures, mandrakes, the only other place that it's mentioned anywhere in the Bible, is in connection with sex. They were thought to be in an aphrodisiac. And what she's saying here, he has been building her up and affirming her, and she's suggesting, let's go spend some time together. Let's go lodge in the villages. Let's go get a condo out in Palm Springs. And let's spend a few days, and there, I'm going to give you my love. Let's go on a little love holiday. And then she says something interesting. She said, you know, we're going to bring forth fruits, all manner new and old, that I've laid up for you. She put a lot of thought into this. And she's basically saying, listen, this is not going to be predictable, my dear. This is not going to be stale and boring. I got some old things for you and I've got some new things for you. We're going to invest in our relationship. We're going to have some unhurried time together. There needs to be companionship. And then the third thing is closeness with God. If you're going to affair-proof your marriage, draw close to God. When Potiphar's wife tempted Joseph to sleep with her, his response was, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? He He was too close to God to do it. He didn't want to harm his relationship with God. So to affair-proof our marriages, affirming communication, companionship or unhurried time together, and closeness with God. All right, the next commandment, and you don't need to turn back to Exodus, was you shall not steal. Very, very important. Be a person of integrity. Someone that's always cheating or cutting corners, it'll be hard for your spouse to respect you because they know what you're really like. Your uprightness should make your husband feel proud. Your uprightness should make your wife feel proud. I read a story one time, broke my heart, because it was about a preacher. His two boys wanted a dog, and he hadn't gotten him one, and one day a stray dog turned up at the door. They sort of adopted the dog. The boys loved it. The whole family loved it. It was just sort of a perfect fit, like the dog that was meant to be theirs. But about a week or maybe 2 weeks later, he gets a call from a stranger, says, I heard you all picked up a stray dog. My dog ran away, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and this is what it looked like. He described the dog, and it was exactly like the dog that had come to their house. Well, the preacher, not wanting to, you know, disappoint his sons and have to give the dog away, said, well, you know, there's a lot of dogs that look like this. There's no proof that it's actually your dog. And the guy said, well, actually, there is. He says, if you look on his tail, he has this coal black tail. There's three very coarse white hairs in the middle of the tail. You can't miss them. There's just three big, thick white hairs. He looks at it. Sure enough, there's those three white hairs. Well, the guy's going to come over to collect his dog. And what Daddy did is he got a pair of tweezers and pulled all three of those hairs out. Guy gets there and, oh, it's my dog. He says, wait a minute, you said there was three white hairs on the tail. Better look. There's no white hairs there. Guy went away without his dog. And in the man's statement, he said, he had three sons. He said, that day we gained a dog, but I lost three boys for Christ. His son saw that Daddy had no integrity. They thought, well, if he lies about this, maybe he lies about everything else. If he's willing to steal this man's dog, maybe this other stuff he's saying isn't true. We need to be people of integrity. Your spouse and your family should be the first ones to testify about your uprightness and your integrity. It really does affect a marriage, my friend. All right, commandment number 9, don't bear false witness. In other words, be truthful. Don't lie. Don't be malicious. If someone would lie about their neighbor for whatever reason, they're liable to lie about anything. That kind of person won't make a good marriage partner. Honesty and truth are at the heart of a good marriage. Unfortunately, over the years, I have been called upon sometimes in a situation within our own flock or outside of it, where someone has told lies in order to protect themselves. They've jeopardized other people's jobs and positions to protect their own thing and actually lied about someone else to cover their own wrongdoing. And I've had to step in a number of times and said, you know what? A person that would do that, you know, shouldn't be working in your organization or shouldn't be working here, whatever it might be. Really hard to have a marriage relationship with someone that will lie to protect themselves. There was a guy was in an automobile accident, and he wasn't hurt, but thought, you know, I'm going to get some money out of this. And so he feigned an injury to his shoulder and to his arm. And, you know, he went after this poor lady that you know, had accidentally hit his car, and, you know, just said, oh, she's hurt my arm, and I need all this money for pain and suffering, and, oh, you know, I've just done so much damage. And so, you know, the attorney, you know, for the insurance company goes before the guy and says, well, you know, how high can you lift your arm since the accident? And he goes, that's all the higher I can lift it. Just like that. And he says, well, how high could you lift it before the accident? He says, oh, I could lift it that high. Just like that. Obviously, he lost the case. But you know what? If you'll find someone that will lie for personal gain or to cover their own rear end and let somebody else, you know, go down the tubes for them, they will not make a good marriage partner. And then finally, number 10, the 10th commandment, which you shall not covet. Don't be discontented with what you have. Don't make what you don't have the focus of your life. Accentuate what you do have. And accentuate what God has given you and what God has given your spouse and celebrate that. Learn to appreciate your wife's strengths. Learn to appreciate your husband's giftings rather than focusing on what he doesn't have and what he's not gifted with. Now, I'm not everything, and I can't do everything. I look at my wife's brothers. You know, she's a farm girl from central Wisconsin. And her brothers can make anything or fix anything. I'm glad she doesn't compare me with them. The tractor breaks down, they can fix the tractor. They can fix cars, they can work on cars. Her brother Earl just recently built a house from the ground up. I'm not real mechanical. That's not my forte. I'm sure I could learn if I applied myself, but I have no desire to learn how to work on a car. I'm going to let somebody else work on my car. That doesn't do anything for me. But there are other areas that I have a bent towards. There are things that I do love. I like to write. I like to teach. I mean, I like to find out about other cultures. I want to eat your food and I want to find out about your history. And there's just some areas that I'm gifted in and some things I like to do. But there's some things I'm not. If you're looking for a Mr. Fix-It that wants to go to the drag races when they're in town, I'm not your boy. I'm glad Janet didn't want a Mr. Fix-It when she got married. And you know, sometimes we tend to look at everything that our husband doesn't have and we compare him with somebody else. And it's like we begin to covet. No, God says, hey, be satisfied. Be content with what you have. A friend of mine wrote a song. It's brilliant. Talking about your wife. So she may not be everything you want, but she's everything you need. That's a good line. He may not be everything you want, but he's everything you need. And if you'll help encourage him in the giftings that he has and celebrate those things, rather than contrast everything he's not or everything she's not, you'll be a whole lot happier. And if the grass looks greener on the other side of the fence, try watering your own grass. If you hop the fence, you're going to find out it may be AstroTurf anyway, and it's just not green grass like you thought it was. Now, these commandments that we talked about tonight, literally, I think in a very literal sense, you know, God was speaking out of a love relationship with His people and said, look, if we're going to have this relationship, these things need to be in place and functioning. Now, I don't know if the statistics are true. I hope they're not. But I've got a book upstairs that's, you know, done all of this, you know, polling and different things. And it's actually a book on youth, but it talks about how many teenagers come from broken homes. And I was shocked in the book said that more than 50% of Christian marriages end in divorce. That hurts. Maybe you've been through 3 divorces. Just don't let it happen again. Let's make what we have work. Let's sow into the relationships we do have. And if you're single and want to be married, hooray for you. I reckon God's got somebody for you. Don't get frustrated. And don't fall into the trap thinking, well, if I just find Mr. Right, or if I just find this person, then I will be whole. Or if I just find this perfect girl, then she's going to make me whole. No. It takes 2 whole people to make a good relationship. If you think, you know, his dysfunction is going to cancel out your dysfunction, you're in for a rude awakening. What you're going to have is double the dysfunction. Right now you have this great opportunity to concentrate on Jesus and give your all to Him and making yourself that right person. And if you'll concentrate on doing that, I believe God will bring that person into your life that you can glorify God through your marriage with. And if you're married right now and going through a struggle, and you know, some folks never suspect. Sometimes we put on our good, happy face when we come to church, and we're going through hell at home, and we think, oh, you know, I gotta put on my game face, not let anybody know that, you know, I'm in a storm or that my marriage is in trouble, you know, so I'm gonna smile and say, praise the Lord, doing great. Oh, how you doing? Wonderful, everything's great. And it's not true. And get some help. Begin to apply things. And don't you fall into the trap of thinking, well, my husband just needs to change, or my wife just needs to change. The only one in your marriage you can change is you. You can't change them. You make the decision that you're going to be the conduit through which God can flow into that relationship. And when God has a channel to come in, things can begin to turn around. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes if you would? And I'm just asking you to do that.